The Devolutionist by Homer Eon Flint. Chapter 13. The Rebel. Meanwhile, Billy was still haunting Mona, and shortly was able to tell the other three that Fort had called, taking the surgeon out in a machine large enough to hold them both. They proceeded to a nearby park, where a game of aerial punt ball was already in progress. Footnote. The game is described more or less completely in various sporting publications. Billy took great interest in the darting play of the little fly-like machines, the action of the mechanical catapults, and the ease with which the 12-inch ball was usually caught in baskets on the machine's prows. She reported the score from time to time in a manner which would have made a telegrapher jealous. Returning from the game, Mona and Fort became pretty confidential, the natural result of a common enthusiasm, for their side won. But Fort was content for a while to merely watch Mona, who was driving. Finally, the conversation made an opening for him to say, "I asked your mother, Mona, what she thought of me as a prospective son-in-law." The girl was in no way rattled. "I suppose she told you that it wouldn't make any difference what she might say. I'd do as I pleased, anyhow. Didn't she?" Fort nodded, slightly taken aback. Then his boldness returned. "Well, I had to bring up the subject somehow, and now that I've done it, do you love me well enough to marry me, Mona?" She pretended to be very busy with the driving, so that Billy never knew whether Fort looked anxious or not. Presently Mona said, I rather think I like you too well to marry you. What I mean is, I'm afraid it would spoil you, my dear boy. You're too well satisfied with yourself. I don't want to marry a man who is content to fly around half the time and admire me the other half, although," she added, "I like to be admired as well as anyone." Fort looked as though he would, with an ounce more provocation, take her in his arms and say something to get quick results. But he didn't. "I see." Pretty soberly for him. "You want me to get in and do something important? Like Powart?" suddenly. But Mona would not answer him directly. "It's only fair to say that I've given him an ultimatum, too." She hinted at what she had told the chairman. "I said nothing about you." Fort took a deep breath. Mona gave him a glance or two, and Billy could see a startling change come over him. It was amazing. Fort, for the first time in his life, had made a serious resolve. "This makes everything very different," he declared, and even his voice was altered. There was a determined, purposeful ring about it, which was altogether unlike his usual reckless tones. "Thanks for not telling Mr. Powart," Fort went on, in the same quiet way. "Clearly, I should tell him myself, and I shall. After that, it is up to me." Next instant, he had thrown off his seriousness, and for the remainder of the flight was his former jovial self. He seemed a trifle ashamed, however, of his old light-heartedness, so much so that Mona warned him not to tamper too much with his disposition. "I like it too well, boy." He went straight home after a hurried leave-taking, and Mona did not see him again until after the declaration of war. The next the four heard of him was through Van Emmon. Fort called upon the self-made commander-in-chief as quickly as he could. "I have the honor to inform you," said Fort, coming straight to the point, "that Miss Mona has seen fit to encourage my suit. In short, sir," with the strange new note of resolution in his voice, "I am your rival for her hand. I thought it only right that you should know." Poet took this as he took everything, standing. And Van Emmon could see no sign that the announcement had disturbed his poise.
"You are considerate," he stated with the faintest trace of sarcasm. "Let me call your attention to the fact that because of the position which recent events have forced upon me, it is quite within my power to dispose of your opposition." Significantly.
"Quite so. I shall appreciate your consideration also." Then the athlete permitted himself a slight smile. "On second thoughts, however, you can't afford to be other than considerate. If anything happens to me now, Miss Mona will naturally think of you, for she knows I have come here." A single exclamation escaped Powart, and from the light in Fort's eyes, Van Emmon knew that the chief was sorely provoked. However, he spoke with his usual coolness and certainty.
"Under the circumstances, you will be exempt, Mr. Fort, from the conscription which is now under way. I shall do nothing that might hinder your activities in any way. I take it, evenly, that you hope to accomplish something big?" Fort bowed.
"It is my intention to set a mark even further than your own, sir." For the first time, Poet laughed. It was a really hearty laugh, as though Fort's preposterous boast was so utterly ridiculous that sarcasm was out of place.
"Mr. Fort," when his mirth had subsided, "I only wish your judgment was as sound as your optimism. Tell me, do you intend to make yourself ruler of a bigger world than this?"
Fort dropped his seriousness for an instant.
"To tell the truth, Powart, I haven't any plan at all, yet. Thanks for the exemption. In return, I assure you that whatever I do will be as truly in the interests of the people as what you have done."
Powart eyed him keenly. For a moment, Van Emmon thought he would try to learn if Fort had any suspicions. But he said nothing further than a curt,
"The audience is ended."
A few minutes later, Billy, through Mona, knew that Fort was reporting progress. He did it by telephone.
"Thought you'd like to know," he finished. "Hope I didn't rouse you out of bed."
It was night in Mona's part of the world, and Billy had come upon the girl just as she was preparing for bed.
"Thank you," she said through a tremendous yawn. "I was just about to retire. Good luck." Another yawn. "And good..."
Her voice changed.
"Mr. Fort,"
sharply. "Powart's declaration of war on Alma is a frame-up. Never mind how I happen to know. It is true. They are not planning to invade us at all. He trumped up this affair in order to make himself dictator."
"What?"
The athlete was astounded. "Are you sure of this, Mona?" The girl's manner had changed again.
"I beg your pardon," she inquired, vastly confused. "Did I say something that... Why, I am not aware, Mr. Fort, that I had said anything more than good night." "You aren't!"
His voice was strained and excited.
"Mona, you just now said something of the most extraordinary... Surely, incredulously... You recall saying something, don't you?"
She was still bewildered.
"I do not."
Then gathering her poise again,
"What did I say?" "You said..."
He stopped and waited a long while before going on. Then he stated, with a soberness that was almost stern,
"Mona, you told me something which could have come only through a supernatural agency. I am sure of it from your manner. You were temporarily possessed."
He paused again. She sensed his earnestness and spoke just as seriously.
"It is not impossible. I have heard of such things before. I was sleepy and... The point is, what did I say?"
she demanded.
"I do not intend to tell you.
What I learned gives me a great advantage over Powart. That's all I can say. More would be dishonorable. Will you take my word for that, Mona? Certainly. With swift decision and a grace that Billy envied. Whereupon she went to bed, but not to sleep, until after many an hour of wide-eyed wondering. Fort next showed himself to Smith through Reblong. He had secured a pass to the engine room of the Cobulus, and shortly his breezy manner completely broke down the engineer's usual reserve. "Always glad to show the machinery," said Reblong, denying that the visitor was making any trouble. Fort's technical knowledge had delighted him. "Come again, any time you like." Which Fort did, the very next day. And this time he brought a package of sweetmeats, during the eating of which the two men became pretty friendly. "You're different from most of the folks of your station," Reblong finally made bold to remark. "Any harm in my saying so?" "On the contrary," laughed the athlete. "I rather pride myself on my democracy." "The fact is, I want you to tell me a few things about your fellow workers. I understand you're one of the officers of your guild?" "Secretary," replied Reblong, a little dubiously. "Was Fort a secret investigator?" "Then you can tell me. Is there any dissatisfaction? Are the men entirely content with their treatment?" Reblong hesitated about replying, and Fort assured him, "This is a purely personal matter with me, old man. I am really anxious to know whether the working world is as well satisfied, as happy as I am." And thus Fort discovered, just as another man had already discovered, that the average Capellan workman was entirely satisfied with what he knew to be unjust treatment. Even when Fort told Reblong what he had learned about Powart's trickery, leaving out all the details about Mona, of course, the engineer would not listen to any hint of revolution. "I don't like to question your word, Mr. Fort." Reblong was very uncomfortable. "But I have such confidence in the commission that, well, you understand." And Fort said, just as the other fellow had said after talking with Reblong, Reblong, the representative Capellan workman, Reblong, who voiced the opinions of his billions of fellow workmen when he refused to consider a rebellion, Fort said, "Well, I'll be utterly damned." Chapter 14. Under Martial Law. Van Emmon was pretty cross because Billy, through Mona, had told Fort about Powart's game. More than once he protested hotly, "You shouldn't have done that. It's all their affair, not ours." And Billy usually returned just as warmly, "I don't care. I think Powart is a scoundrel." And it was in the midst of one of these tiffs that the doctor interrupted, exactly as though the telepathy was telephony. "Quiet, you two. Fort has called at the prison and is being introduced to young Ernol. He—" "I've been talking to your father," Fort was saying to the son. The guard had left them alone in the cell. "But he isn't interested in my ideas. He seems to think he's done all that needs to be done in getting himself imprisoned." The boy nodded. "He considers himself a martyr, Mr. Fort. And I guess he's satisfied, like everybody else." He spoke bitterly. All Fort's own youthful enthusiasm returned with a rush. "You're just the chap I'm looking for. If you're genuinely ambitious to do the people a great service, now's your chance." And he went on to tell the boy about Powart's frame-up. He gave every detail of Mona's strange disclosure, and the boy believed him absolutely. "I might have known there was some trick about it," cried the lad. "Alma isn't that kind of planet. By heaven, Powart deserves to be assassinated."
"Nothing doing," replied the athlete promptly, his eyes sparkling with the old light. "The first thing is to get you out of here, you and the other 150 who were put in at the same time."
Whereupon he proceeded to outline a scheme such as would look utterly incredible in the mere planning. perhaps it is best to relate the thing as it happened instead. 2 nights after Fort's call on Ernol, Fort again presented himself to Reblong. This time it was at the engineer's apartments.
"I was hoping to find you about to go on duty. I've been wondering how your engines control the steering."
He was eyeing Reblong steadily.
"Sometime when it is convenient, I wish you would show me all over the ship and explain everything."
He turned as though to leave.
"Oh, that's all right, Mr. Fort," Reblong hurried to assure him. "I'd just as soon accommodate you right now as at any other time. The ship is always open to me."
Reblong had said exactly what Fort had hoped and planned that he would say. 15 minutes later, the two men were inside the big air cruiser, alone except for a few cleaners, who were finishing the usual work of preparing the ship for its next cruise. But Reblong could not know that Fort had carefully made sure of this fact beforehand. The engineer took the athlete from one end of the cruiser to the other, showing him how the pilot was able to control its motions with the utmost delicacy, thanks to automatic mechanism in the engine room, electrically connected with the bridge.
"Suppose I was the pilot now," commented Fort, standing on the bridge and looking up at the stars. "All I need to do is to set these dials," indicating the pilot's instruments, "to ascend, and the engine room would do the rest automatically. Is that it?"
Reblong said this was practically true, and led the way back to the engine room. The place was full of a gurgling sound now, due to the fuel being run into the tanks. Reblong glanced at the indicating tube.
"We've already got enough," he estimated, "to take the ship 1,000 miles.
And next instant, Fort had leapt upon him. Reblong staggered back in his surprise, stumbled against a chair, and sat down heavily, helpless as a child in the athlete's iron grip.
"Sorry, old man," remarked Fort, meanwhile pushing him, chair and all, towards the instrument table. "But it's simply got to be done."
Like a flash, he let go the engineer and snatched the strap from the table, where he had, of course, previously placed it, and again threw himself upon his man before Reblong recovered from his surprise. In a second he was strapped tight in his chair, and not until then did he think to use his feet. Another strap put an end to his kicking.
"Surprised you, didn't I?"
The athlete was enjoying himself hugely.
"Now, I must remind you that I'm taking a big chance in doing this. If you make a noise, I shall treat you as any desperate man would treat you."
There was a look in his eyes which clinched the matter. Immediately, he disappeared in the direction of the nearest cleaners. Reblong heard sounds of struggling from time to time, and evidently he implicitly believed that Fort would take vengeance upon him if he called for help, for he kept perfectly quiet. After perhaps 20 minutes, the athlete returned, breathing heavily but happy.
"The last one almost spilled my beans," said he, to use the expression Smith employed. "He happened to see me shutting another one into a closet and jumped me from behind. I had to lay him out."
Reblong must have looked alarmed.
"Oh, no harm done. They'll all live to tell about it for the next 20 years.
Next, he made certain adjustments to the engine room mechanism. Then he went to the telephone and located the man in charge of the depot.
"Hello, Mr. Fort speaking. Reblong isn't able to come to the phone."
He winked at the man in the chair.
"There's something wrong with the fuel indicator. Shut off the supply for a while, will you?"
The gurgling soon stopped. Reblong watched in continued silence as Fort disappeared again, this time taking the elevator to the bridge. He was back again in a couple of minutes.
"Now, old man," addressing the engineer, "you can guess what I'm up to. I'm going to navigate this cruiser alone. I've set everything for the ascent. You see what I've done. If I've made any mistakes, it means goodbye for the Cobulus, for me, and for you.
I leave it to your good sense to tell me if there's anything I've overlooked." And he laid his hands on the starting levers. Reblong said nothing so far. Such was his chagrin and wonder. But now he evidently considered seriously what Fort had said.
"I see you mean it, Mr. Fort. And you ought to know that once you've cleared the landing dock, you'll have a hard time to keep her level unless you're up on the bridge. That is, while you're shifting the wing angle. But you ought to be down here to do that, and meanwhile she might nose down and slam into something, and—"
Reblong shuddered.
"I see."
The athlete pondered for a moment. Then he lifted the engineer bodily, chair and all, and moved him over nearer the instrument. Next, he loosened one of Reblong's hands, just enough to permit him to reach certain of the levers. He also did some more tying of knots and shifting of buckles, roped the chair to a stanchion, and made sure that Reblong could not undo himself.
"It's up to you," said Fort, with the new light in his eyes. "You run this thing as it ought to be run, and you're safe. Trick me in any way, and I'll get you."
Reblong took a single look at those eyes.
"I understand," said he, in a low voice.
And without further ado, the athlete went to the elevator. In less than a minute, the order came to cast off. The engineer did not hesitate, but threw the levers and turned the wheels, which Fort had expected to operate himself. Another second, and the great craft was rising from its seat. Shouts, muffled and faint because of the ship's double windows, sounded from outside. Reblong saw the shed sinking rapidly below him. In 30 seconds the vessel was free of the dock.
"First gear ahead," came the signal, and again Reblong obeyed.
Practically he had no choice. Another man of nobler training might have preferred to be loyal at all costs, but Reblong, the representative Capellan workman, saw the lights of the shed shift slowly to the rear, then go out of sight as the speed increased. He saw one or two flyers preparing to pursue, but he knew that the cruiser would easily outstrip the best of them. The Cobulus had got clear away. It was an hour later that the four, this time through the doctor and young Ernol, learned the sequel to Fort's daring feat. The boy was alone in his cell, awake in the darkness, when one of the guards marched up to his door and unlocked it.
"Come out," he ordered,
and Ernol preceded him down the corridor, up a flight of stairs, through another corridor, and thence into the exercise grounds. On the other side of this was a small building, with no opening save one door, now bright with light. Inside, Ernol found the other men who had been arrested with him, closely watched by a dozen of the prison guards. His father was not there. Apparently they were waiting for him to be brought.
"It worked all right," whispered the man at Ernol's right, as the boy was lined up.
Ernol only nodded slightly, keeping his eyes fixed upon the door. A moment later, the elder Ernol arrived, accompanied by a man whom the doctor instantly recognized. It was Eklan Norbith, the man whose infernally ingenious use of the clock's pendulum had wrung the truth about the secret photographs from the boy's father. He looked even more cruel and repellent now than he had that night on the couch. Apparently quite recovered, he made a truly forbidding figure. He had evidently been sent for by the warden, for with a slow, malignant stare at the row of prisoners, he stated the case in his heavy, ominous tones.
"You are all supposed to know the rules. One of you has been smuggling drugs into the prison. We have found specimens in each cell. It only remains to learn which of you is the guilty party, and that I propose to uncover within 1 minute."
He paused and glared around again. The stillness was unbroken for a moment. Then one prisoner coughed nervously. This started half the rest to doing the same, and under cover of the noise, Ernol whispered to the man on his right, "No sign of him yet. I'm afraid you showed the drug too soon."
"I waited until I heard the clock strike," protested the other.
And then both stood on their guard as the commission's deputy went on with his arraignment.
"It is my duty to inform you, although you probably already know it, that this building is made of iron. Floors, wall, and ceiling are the same."
The doctor saw that the prisoner's feet were all bare.
"And the whole place is heavily wired with high-power electricity. The guards and I will now leave you to yourselves."
His teeth showed in an evil smile.
"We will give you a few kilowatts as a starter and shut it off after 10 seconds. If you are not ready by that time to tell me which of you is guilty, I will then let you have the current twice as strong."
The prisoners looked at each other anxiously. Ernol threw back his head defiantly.
"Don't weaken," he exclaimed. "The juice can't hurt you."
Immediately, the guards backed out, keeping their weapons trained on the crowd. Norbith was the last to go. He left the door open, and from where the boy stood, he could plainly watch the man as he worked the switches just outside. Instantly, the place was in an uproar. Of course, the doctor felt nothing of the prickling, nerve-shaking pain that gripped every one of these barefoot men. They leapt and darted here and there, bluish sparks flashing wherever they touched the iron, or they fell after a step or two and writhed on the floor, shrieking and cursing with the exquisite torture of that awful current. Ernol alone kept from shouting. He stood and took it, trembling like a leaf. But it lasted only a moment or two. The uproar ceased. Norbith stepped back into the room.
"Well?" The slow smile again. "Want to tell now?"
For answer, the boy clapped his hand to his mouth and blew a shrill whistle. Norbith stared in astonishment. Then, all of a sudden, a tremendous thing happened. A veritable hurricane swooped down upon the place. There was a vast rush of wind, accompanied by a thunderous noise like breakers. Then two huge masses of metal clanged against the sides of the building. There was a grinding crash, and the whole structure rocked and swayed as though in the grasp of some supernatural monster. Next second, the lights went out. The wires had snapped.
"All aboard! Look out below!" sang out a voice.
It was Fort, calling from far overhead. And then, slowly at first, but with quickening speed, the iron building rose into the air, arose and floated away like a toy balloon. It was fast in the grip of the Cobulus's grappling irons. Norbith was the only officer left in the room. He regained his senses with lightning speed. Out came his electric torch. He trained it on the prisoners.
"By God," he cursed, "you'll not get away, you."
And he fumbled with the weapon in his belt.
It was one of the box-like machine guns. Young Ernol hesitated. Only an instant. Then he dashed forward.
The box spat fire. The boy threw his weight against the deputy so that the man lost his balance and toppled out the door into the arms of the guards below. And the doctor brought his own mind back to his body not 1 second before the lad, burnt through and through by the flame of the man's weapon, fell back into the room, dead. End of chapter 14.